Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know you've been sucked into some sort of internet vortex when you log on to Facebook and all you see is posts about Facebook. That was pretty much the Facebook experience last night, with a few cat videos thrown in for good measure. And the frenzy is far from over. After all, the actual IPO is still months away. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for February 2nd, 2012. Enough with the bad headline puns about Facebook's announcement of a pending initial public offering, but the numbers getting bandied about are staggering. 845 million active users a month, $3.9 billion in cash in the bank, promises of more billions to employees, early investors, hangers-on, you name it. Yesterday's public filing also outlined several challenges the company faces as it goes public, including its ability to hang on as the king of social media, regulatory challenges. And here's one that stood out to us, a letter from founder Mark Zuckerberg about how Facebook has to continue to operate under, quote, the hacker way. Larry Dignan is editor-in-chief at ZDNet, and his column today talks about Facebook's culture. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
You write in your column that Mark Zuckerberg's real challenge is going to be sticking with the hacker way. Talk to us about what that means.
It's basically an idea that you continually improve and iterate. Basically, it's a way to tweak forever. It's basically a culture of tweaking.
And how does he foster that right now?
Well, right now they have open, I guess you'd call them hackathons, so to speak, where they basically, everybody with an idea comes out and does their demos and plays with code. And basically, you know, they have thousands of versions of Facebook running around the company.
Yeah.
So it feels like a very startup culture.
Well, so then I guess the question really is whether going public is going to mean that that culture changes. You know, if you have a bunch of people wanting to take a risk, but at the same time they're keeping one eye on the share price, you know, what happens there?
Yeah, well, I think it's inevitable the culture changes. You saw with Google, you know, you can only get so big and before you start losing, you know, some nimbleness, so to speak. And, you know, the larger you get, the more you need processes and all these other things that go with being a public company, Sarbanes-Oxley, right? So it's all that stuff is kind of a buzzkill compared to the hacker way. So I think Facebook, like other companies, right? I mean, Microsoft is decidedly different today than it was when it was young. I think it's, you know, it's a natural evolution that you have to go through. And I think it's inevitable Facebook is going to struggle with that.
And can you briefly describe for us how Google struggled with that? Because they're kind of, I think, the most recent example of this that we have.
Right. Well, when Larry Page took over, which was earlier, just a few months ago, really, from Eric Schmidt, you know, one thing he did was he started killing projects. Right? Because one of the things that makes Google great is that they just kind of experiment repeatedly. And he basically shut down, you know, a few things. They had clean energy investments. They had all sorts of things going on there. So, you know, it's about focus, right? And companies struggle with that because when you're a public company, you're always looking for more growth. So at some point, that takes you to different directions. And then you just wind up like, you know, a big octopus and you're kind of flailing around. So I think that's, you know, Google's struggling a little bit now because they're much bigger than they used to be.
Yeah.
And I just think that's inevitable, right? Whether you're talking General Electric, Microsoft, Google, Cisco, you know, being big is complicated.
Larry Dignan is the chief editor at ZDNet. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
Now, here's something I never thought I'd say. Next year, I am likely to earn a bigger salary than Mark Zuckerberg. In the papers Facebook filed yesterday, the company revealed that Zuckerberg asked for and was granted a pay cut from a base salary of about $500,000 this year to just one measly dollar in 2013. Of course, he still owns the biggest chunk of Facebook stock. So why is the hoodied one joining the pantheon of dollar CEOs? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith takes a look.
Back in 1978, Lee Iacocca took the helm of a struggling Chrysler and said he would only earn a dollar a year. And a modern American tradition was born. Apple's Steve Jobs, Google's Larry Page, Whole Foods' John Mackey. Sure, these guys had more money than they could probably ever spend. But still, why not get paid for your work? Caitlin Zaloom is a cultural anthropologist at NYU.
The dollar salary is a kind of pact with the workers. You're throwing yourself in with the fates of your employees.
So if a CEO only gets paid in stock, his fate and his company's fate are fused.
That is not what's going on with Facebook.
Zaloom thinks Zuckerberg's salary decision has a lot more to do with the uncomfortable nature of the product he sells, namely us and the information we hand over. He doesn't want there to be a direct connection between that and his money.
By saying, I'm only going to take a dollar, that is actually saying, I'm not even going to acknowledge that your labor is adding to my wealth.
Or maybe the message is that wealth is beside the point, says James Fowler, a social media expert at the University of San Diego.
The message is that Facebook is not about money, it's about other things.
Fowler points out the Dollar Salary Club is chock full of tech CEOs. The message? Silicon Valley isn't Wall Street. Its goals are things like think different, don't be evil, then share with friends. And if they happen to make billions of dollars in capital gains, well, so be it. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, maybe investors are just going to wait things out until the Facebook IPO because stocks barely budged today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The setup to this next story sounds a bit like a bad joke. What do a bunch of lawyers do when they can't get jobs? Well, they sue, naturally. Yesterday, a group of recent law graduates sued a dozen law schools. They say the schools misled them about job and salary prospects. It's not even the first time this week that a school has been accused of false advertising. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
When Adam Bevilacqua applied to Brooklyn Law School, its job placement rates were a big selling point. He says the school reported that at least 90% of students found work after they graduated.
Unless I was like the bottom 10% of the class or something like that, I was virtually guaranteed legal employment within 9 months of graduation.
He graduated almost 9 months ago with $100,000 in debt and passed the bar on the first try. Since then, he's only been able to find temp jobs outside the legal profession.
Anything from data entry to front desk type work to babysitting, which is actually what I'm doing right now.
Bevilacqua is part of the group suing law schools for allegedly inflating their employment figures by hiring their own graduates for temporary work or counting employment in other industries. Job placement data influence a school's standing in the all-important U.S. News and World Report rankings. Earlier this week, Claremont McKenna College admitted it inflated students' SAT scores to boost its ranking. William Henderson teaches law at Indiana University. He says the rankings have become too important.
And frankly, I have a lot of sympathy for the teens on that front because the alumni and the students are inconsolable when the rankings go down.
The American Bar Association, which accredits many law schools, is making changes. It will require schools to report more detailed job numbers. Henderson says that won't take the pressure off, but it will give applicants more useful information. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The Environmental Protection Agency puts out a green power list every few months. It ranks companies by how much clean energy they use, wind, solar, biofuel, what have you. And in the latest list, a new name broke into the top three, Walmart. It was way down in 15th place just a few months ago. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troh has that story.
The EPA lists top renewable energy users as part of its Green Power Partnership. Blaine Collison directs the project. He says it's exciting to see who lands on top, but no internal bets.
There would certainly be no betting in a federal workplace, but I really enjoy watching the lists move.
They don't move all that much. Intel has been number one for green energy the past few years. But Walmart did just knock Whole Foods down a notch. Last quarter, only 8% of Walmart's electricity came from renewable sources. 3 months later, it's up to 28%. That's because Walmart flipped the switch on several energy projects at once, says Energy Director David Osment. Walmart wants to run the whole company on renewable power. Osment says they're tackling it bit by bit.
Renewable energy is a lot of fun and very rewarding, but we also got to do it in a cost-effective way.
That means using more wind and solar in states that have incentives, like California and Texas. But renewables can also reduce costs in places where Walmart's electric bills are rising.
A 1% change in energy price to us means a lot of dollars.
Millions of dollars that could be saved if Walmart locks in a price with a solar company instead of staying with the local utility. Eric Olson at Business for Social Responsibility says that goes for any business that uses lots of power.
It's not an industry-specific phenomenon. These are moves that can work for any company.
Moves we'll see a lot more of, he says, as the price of solar panels and other technology continues to fall. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel is in China all this week. She's plugging German exports and telling Chinese leaders how the European Union will tackle its debt crisis. The EU wants China to contribute to the bailout fund. Today, Premier Wen Jiabao said his country is considering greater involvement. But that is generating some skepticism. Our China correspondent Rob Schmidt has more.
A spokesperson for Merkel says the German leader will seek to rebuild confidence in efforts to stabilize the situation in the EU. Andrew Batson heads China research at Dragonomics in Beijing. He says the Chinese have been puzzled why it's taken EU leaders 16 emergency summits to try and tackle the debt problem.
I mean, there's been a lot of summits and agreements and promises, and frankly, it's pretty difficult to keep track of all the things that are supposed to be happening.
The Chinese, says Batson, are eager for the details. Zhao Daozhong is a professor of international relations at Peking University.
I would very much doubt that this was a time for a very solid Chinese promise to say, yes, here is that amount of money you requested from our foreign exchange reserve just for the sake of stabilizing the euro, because we have a lot of domestic needs for that money as well.
After the 2008 economic crisis, China spent $500 billion on a domestic stimulus package to help jumpstart the global economy. Jia says a lot of China's current economic problems stem from how poorly that money was spent. The Chinese will politely nod and smile during Merkel's trip this week. They won't be digging into their pockets. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
On Monday, the good people of Britain, Her Majesty's loyal subjects, will start a series of national celebrations to mark her 60 years on the throne. But as the country embarks on this diamond jubilee, there's quite a bit of talk, sotto voce, about Queen Elizabeth II's advancing years. Her grandson, Prince Harry, recently said that her arduous range of duties means she's doing things she shouldn't be doing at her age. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Deafened by trumpets on a daily basis, rattling around in a gilded horse-drawn carriage.
I name this lifeboat Richard Cox Scott. May God bless her.
Launching ships, hosting banquets and waving from balconies. Yep, it's a hard life being a queen. In fact, says Ingrid Seward, editor of Majesty magazine, it's a grueling existence.
Well, the queen is extraordinarily hard-working, and she always has been. But, I mean, it is pretty full-on. I mean, for somebody of 85, very exhausting.
Meeting ambassadors, opening hospitals, knighting people and pinning on medals. Last year, the Queen clocked up 370 official engagements. There'll be even more in this Diamond Jubilee year.
We're having a Jubilee. I think we ought to cancel the Jubilee.
Professor Stephen Hazler thinks the Queen should cut her workload completely. In fact, to abdicate. He wants a republic, and he thinks the Diamond Jubilee celebrations at a time of austerity are an insult.
And I think the Jubilee ought to be cancelled this year, just as a mark of respect for the people of Britain who are going through a difficult time.
The Jubilee won't be cancelled, of course, for the royal family, which likes to call itself the firm. This year will be business as usual. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, Nevada went all in on housing before the recession, but now recent college grads are finding they have very few options.
It's very disheartening to have worked so hard for 4 or 5 years and you're ready for the world and the world just kind of doesn't want you and you just kind of don't have those options, and so it's very disheartening.
But first, let's do the numbers. Mixed earnings made for mixed trading today on Wall Street. The Dow dipped 11 points, just under 0.1% to finish at 12,705. The Nasdaq rose 11 points, 0.4% to close at 2859. And the S&P 500 tacked on 1 point, that's 0.1%, to end at 1325. Shares of Boston Scientific were among the losers. The healthcare device maker gave back 4% after reporting lower quarterly earnings. Health insurer Cigna missed profit expectations. Its stock coughed up 3.3%. On the upside, earnings for Green Mountain Coffee blew past analyst expectations. Shares of the coffee seller perked up nearly 24%. MasterCard also beat earnings. And the credit card company's shares charged up 6.2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for January. The Commerce Department releases factory orders for December. And opt out of Casual Friday in favor of something fashionable and fabulous and colorful. It's National Wear Red Day to call attention to heart disease in women. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. The next battle for the GOP nomination happens on Saturday. Nevada holds its caucuses. The Silver State was hotly contested in 2008, and since then it's been a hotbed of the housing crisis. As part of special Marketplace election coverage on the real economy, we're looking today at one of the most important voting blocks in the state, unions. Ruben Garcia is a professor of labor law at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What is the union landscape in Nevada? As we know, unions have been under fire in many parts of the country. What's it like there?
Well, you have a large portion of the labor movement here in the service sector, in the hospitality industry. So the Culinary Workers Union Local 226 is the dominant union in the Las Vegas area. But there's also a significant portion of construction unions. That proportion has decreased recently with the downturn in the economy, but they still play a large role in the elections. And you also have public employees who also are active politically.
Well, let me pick up on the construction union. Given the obvious issues with construction, particularly there in your state, how are those union members feeling this time around, as opposed to, say, 2008?
Well, I think that there's always going to be a question about whether the last 4 years have been good to working people. In many indicators, that has not been the case, whether it's housing or wage stagnation. So the question really is whether priorities have been realized, whether or not all of the hope for change that unions were looking for in the election of President Obama have come to fruition.
And is there any way to predict how that might go?
Well, I think it's going to be a very close election. Everyone acknowledges that, that it will be very hard fought. But there's also the idea of the alternative. If the other party is actively against those priorities that labor has and the Democrats have simply been able to overcome that opposition, then it's still, you know, quite likely that most of the labor movement will be in the Democrats' camp again this year. We also know that unions in every election can contribute a lot of people mobilization. They can provide resources to get people to the polls. The hospitality workers union, the culinary, will probably be a significant force in the election. Maybe less so, however, the construction trades because of their loss of membership, loss of people power that they have suffered in the recession.
Has the hospitality industry seen that as well, though? I mean, I know that Las Vegas proper was hit terribly in the recession. Is that coming back? Will that make a difference?
Well, there are still a significant portion of the labor movement. There are 60,000 or so members of the culinary in the Las Vegas area. And this is speaking mostly about the southern half of the state. In the northern half of the state, there are certainly other factors. But in the Las Vegas area, there's still a significant force politically. There have been, of course, layoffs recently, but not on the scale that we've seen in the construction industry.
Ruben Garcia is a professor of labor law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A strong case could be made that the Silver State suffered the greatest damage from the Great Recession. Nevada is at the top of all the wrong lists: unemployment, foreclosures, state budget shortfalls. And so it is where we launched coverage from our new Wealth and Poverty Desk as part of our election reporting. The desk will explore how our economy affects people at all levels. Today we bring you the voices of college seniors in Nevada. They have survived university funding cuts and tuition increases, and now they're getting ready to graduate into a job market that is unpromising, to say the least. Here's Marketplace's Sarah Gardner.
You know that image of the coddled American college student, bubble-wrapped from the harsh realities of the work world? Hard to find in Nevada.
I work actually at the Caesars Palace. I sell tickets to shows at the Coliseum.
That's one of student Sarah Sines' part-time jobs.
It was a receptionist job at an Alzheimer's daycare. I did give that up because I started working on campus as well.
Sines was typical of the seniors I met at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and at Nevada State College in the suburb of Henderson. These 20-somethings live at home, work part-time jobs, and worry about their parents as well as themselves. Sines' dad is a realtor in Las Vegas.
So he actually works as a busboy in downtown for a second job now.
The recession's been tough on Nevada college students. Since June of 2007, the legislature has slashed funding for universities and colleges about 25% on average, and tuition's gone up nearly 50% on average. Ashley Brown has returned to college after failing to find a job with a BA in psychology. She's now studying law enforcement and bracing herself for next year's 8% tuition hike.
It just seems so hard to imagine that, because it's like it just keeps going up and up and up and up and up.
Samantha Bledsoe is working on a BA in education so she can teach high school English. It's taking longer than she expected.
My degree has been pushed back. I'll be graduating a year later because of the class cuts due to the budget cuts, because they're not offering the courses that I need.
Last year, the legislature considered closing Nevada State because of the budget crisis. Didn't happen, but all the uncertainty has demoralized students, says the school's newspaper editor, Stephanie Herrera.
I don't want to say it's a slap in the face, but it sort of feels like it sometimes. It's almost like these tuition increases and budget cuts are telling us, just, you know, quit it, go into something like entertainment, and, you know, just go that route.
Stephanie's talking about those low-skilled but well-paid jobs in Nevada's gambling and tourism industries. Student Joseph Lopez tells of a friend who gave up her medical studies to become a cocktail waitress. That and another part-time job in Vegas earn her nearly six figures a year.
When you're already struggling and your choices are limited and you have that as a fallback, I mean, like, who wouldn't fall back on that? So that's a loophole, that's a trap that I see so far.
Many students here want to stay in Nevada, but the one-horse economy and high jobless rate may drive them out. Doesn't help that their friends who graduated are working temp jobs or at the mall.
Forever 21, H&M, seriously, retail.
That's where Sarah Sines' friends have found jobs. Her friend Donovan Kanashiro, a journalism major who finishes this spring, says a lot of graduates he knows are losing hope.
It's very disheartening to have worked so hard for 4 or 5 years and you're ready for the world and the world just kind of doesn't want you and you just kind of don't have those options. And so it's very disheartening.
One option, these students say, wait out the bad economy in grad school. In Las Vegas, Nevada, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, going to small claims court usually involves small claims with judgments worth, hundreds of dollars. But a woman here in Los Angeles proved that is not always the case. She won just shy of the maximum $10,000 allowed in small claims, and she won it against Honda Motor Company. Heather Peters sued the car maker for saying that the Civic Hybrid she bought could get 50 miles per gallon of gas when the most she got was 42. She chose not to take part in a class action settlement that would have given her about $100 and a coupon toward a new car. Honda says it will appeal. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today the Dow dipped 11 points, nearly a tenth of a percent. The NASDAQ rose 11 points, 0.4%. And the S&P 500 tacked on 1 point, just over a tenth of a percent. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, Marketplace heads to Las Vegas to find out what is on the minds of Nevada voters.
I think our economy sucks.
I am so optimistic and excited for the things that are going to happen.
I am hopeful that the economy will get better because I would like a job.
The Real Economy, our coverage of what really matters in this election, continues. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.